This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Fires race across the poles. The sea is coming in.
Why are so many experts and bloggers predicting more cold outbreaks as the planet warms? Our UK scientist Edward Hanna explains. What happened the last time Earth's atmosphere carried so much carbon dioxide? Welcome to the mid-Pliocene warm period. With just 400 parts per million CO2, Earth went over 3 degrees C hotter. Sea levels were at least 20 feet, maybe double that, higher than they are today. We get the inside scoop in New Science, led by New Zealand scientist Georgia Grant. High Science and Deep Time, this week on Radio EcoShock. Humans did not know much about the stratosphere until the last century. We can't see it. Sound doesn't carry from there, and it doesn't travel well in that thin air. Large three-dimensional waves of air do move about in the stratosphere like ocean currents. Pushed by differences in temperature and pressure, the strongest stratospheric winds are around the poles. These circular winds usually flow counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere and clockwise around the South Pole. Sometimes they collapse and flow the other way in a sudden stratospheric warming. Polar vortex winds keep the coldest air on Earth circulating around the poles and not further south into the mid-latitudes where the majority of humanity live. As we hear from our first guest, Dr. Edward Hanna, that protection can break down. Keep in mind, despite what TV forecasters say, the stratospheric polar vortex is not the same as the jet stream. That is lower down in the troposphere. The stratosphere is less turbulent than the troposphere, and that's why big jets may fly up to 36,000 feet or more above 11,000 meters, because it is calmer up there. Previously, we thought all weather happens in the troposphere, while the stratosphere was just calm and stable. But now the separation between the weather layer and the stratosphere is not complete. We know that certain energy events in the troposphere can influence those stratospheric winds. But our interest here is the other way around. How do variations in stratospheric polar vortex winds change our weather? Is this why large regions can be hit with a severe cold outbreak, even as the world warms? We are seeing warmer and warmer winters, no doubt about that. Each year competes for the warmest winter ever recorded. Then, strangely, Arctic air events arrive in the south. Take the atmospheric cold blob over Scandinavia and northwestern Russia 2 years ago. It was in the winter running from October 2023 to January 2024. The rest of the planet was record hot, coming out of the phenomenally hot year of 2023. According to a 2024 study on this Russo-Scandinavian cold blob, quote, on 5 January 2024, the temperature dropped to minus 44 C in Vitagi, Sweden, and to minus 44.3 C recorded at Antanakio Airport, Finland. Both readings were the lowest temperatures ever recorded in their respective countries in the 21st century. End quote. Skiers and ice fishers loved it, but electricity prices hit an all-time high in Finland. Rails, roads, and ferries in Scandinavia shut down in the cold, along with some schools. The study authors noted, people may be more vulnerable to severe cold because they occur less frequently nowadays. Let's talk about the cold weather threat not to humans, but to what we eat. Meteorologist and climate scientist Judah Cohen publishes studies of extreme weather while working for a private company. In an interview, I asked Judah, who buys forecasts which include developments in the stratospheric polar vortex? Cohen gave the example of grain futures traders. If you could know winter wheat might be damaged by a cold air outbreak, you might make money betting on that, or you might make trades that readjust the global wheat pricing based on availability. I took a look at winter wheat. About a third of humans depend on wheat as a staple crop. 80% of all wheat is winter wheat. It is planted in the fall to let it develop a root system and a few leaves ahead of spring. In February 2025, Reuters reported Chicago wheat future prices hit a four-month high as cold threatened winter wheat in both America and Russia. On the Great Plains, a January 2025 cold air outbreak brought temperatures as low as minus 40 degrees C, which is about the same as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. A previous dry fall made the wheat more fragile to cold. Soil with less moisture gets colder faster than moist soil. The classic case of cold air outbreak was the North American winter storm of February 13th to 17th, 2021. The cold traveled south all the way to Texas and northern Mexico. Texas experienced the largest electricity blackout in the U.S. since the big blackout of 2003 in the Northeast. The cold outbreak in Texas killed about 700 people. Pipes burst, refineries shut down, power plants went offline. Infrastructure was not built for such cold, and Texas chose an isolated power system that couldn't draw help from neighboring states. The event was preceded by a sudden stratospheric warming event in January, which can disrupt the polar vortex and lead to cold air outbreaks. But a study from the American Meteorological Society found stratospheric changes were not central to this particular cold wave. They found atmospheric variability and predictable La Niña teleconnections were principal causes of the deadly Texas cold snap of 2021. Stay tuned for long-shot predictions favoring unusual cold and snow for North America and parts of Europe next winter. Are all the drivers lining up for a severe cold outbreak?
Radio EcoShock.
It is hard to believe, but in the mid-latitudes where most of us live, winters are warming faster than summers. Except, severely cold air can suddenly break out of the Arctic. Due to changes in the upper atmosphere, a key study shows cold air outbreaks become more likely as the planet warms. The lead author is Professor Edward Hanna from the University of Lincoln, UK. Dr. Hanna published more than 150 peer-reviewed papers. He was a contributing author on the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report and a fellow of the Royal Meteorological Society. Published December 10, 2024, the title for this winter weather warning is Influence of High Latitude Blocking and the Northern Stratospheric Polar Vortex on Cold Air Outbreaks Under Arctic Amplification of Global Warming. From Lincolnshire, England, Edward Hanna, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
If winters are generally warming, why do we care about a cold snap now and then?
So you're right that winters are generally getting warmer in most parts of the planet in the last few decades with human-driven global warming. However, there's always variability with extreme weather events and with climate change. So each year is not necessarily progressively warmer than the previous year. You get fluctuations for a whole variety of reasons. And these include cold winter spells sometimes. So, and also with the warming trend, we're perhaps expecting these cold spells less often than we used to. And so, or less severe than they used to be. And so we're less prepared for them when they do occur. And so we still have been seeing at times some pretty severe winter spells propagating from high northern latitudes in the Arctic down to much lower middle latitudes, such as London, for example, or New York, or that whole band around the middle latitudes of the northern hemisphere. So these cold events continue to occur, albeit on average not as cold as they used to be, but we're perhaps less prepared for them than we used to be. And so we need to deal with this idea that there will always be variations amongst that background of global warming.
Yes, there was a terrible cold snap went down into Texas a few years ago. They weren't ready. The refineries froze up. There was no gas. All sorts of problems. Some people died. So, yes, people aren't ready for what could happen. Now, you led a paper with well-known co-authors like Jennifer Francis, James Overland, and Judah Cohen. What did your group set out to do?
So that's a good question. So I actually organised a workshop in Lincoln, UK, in late 2023, when most of these people together, and also quite a few top experts from Asia as well. Although obviously being in the Northern Hemisphere issue, it's tends to be not Southern Hemisphere people in involved. It's from across the Northern Hemisphere. So we had some really good discussions about where we thought the current gaps in the research on strong Arctic warming and linking that with extreme weather events further afield of the Arctic. So in these densely populated Northern Hemisphere mid-latitude continents where several hundreds of millions of people live. And so obviously the, you know, people can be profoundly affected by various extreme weather events. And also you've got the, what we call the jet stream, which is a giant current of air in the atmosphere in the Northern Hemisphere, crosses many of these Northern Hemisphere mid-latitude regions. So we really wanted to understand where the gaps in the knowledge and understanding were when we're looking at connecting what is happening with very strong warming, particularly of the Arctic regions or the high northern latitudes, the connectivity with the extreme weather events further south. And so from those discussions in the workshop, we really put together some research priorities. And then we were sort of invited, or I was invited, to lead a research synthesis for a fairly newish journal, but from a reputable publisher called Environmental Research Climate. And so that paper came out last December. And so it's an attempt to really convey to the wider science community and to interested other people the kind of situation where we need to go with better understanding these connections between Arctic and mid-latitude climate change and mid-latitude extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere.
And tell us about the warm Arctic, cold continents theory.
So this is a theory that was first put forward by Dr. James Overland of NOAA and colleagues, I think about just over 15 years ago, originally when it was first published in some papers. So the idea that we're seeing very strong warming over the Arctic, which I think we're going to discuss in a bit, but at the same time, we continue to see cold winter spells further south of the Arctic, particularly over the North America and over Eurasia. So it's kind of topsy-turvy or upside-down temperature extremes from what you might expect, where normally you might expect cold conditions or record cold conditions in the Arctic and warmer conditions further south. But actually, some of these temperature patterns or the patterns of the temperature anomalies have flipped on average at times in the last few decades. And so that's what it's really referring to, where we're having still the, at times, very cold conditions in the northern continents.
Over a decade ago, Jennifer Francis suggested a link between disappearing sea ice and winter cold outbreaks. Francis told us on Radio EcoShock she cannot say loss of Arctic sea ice is causing winter weakening in the jet stream, but both changes do occur together. Judah Cohen added the amount of snow cover on land as a factor, especially in Siberia. What is your assessment of the role of disappearing Arctic sea ice and the risk of cold winter outbreaks in North America or Europe?
So the cold weather outbreak in Europe and other extreme weather events, here we're talking obviously about the Northern Hemisphere winter in Europe and the US, the sea ice changes are a possible influence on those changes in extreme mid-latitude cold winter spells, but there's many possible influences because these cold winter spells in mid-latitudes are caused or directly connected with changes in the jet stream that I've already mentioned in the Northern Hemisphere mid-latitude jet stream. And there's many possible causes of those jet stream changes, including changes in tropical climate systems, more locally in the, with the mid-latitude atmospheric or medium-scale storm systems or cyclones, and also further afield, teleconnections in the polar regions and elsewhere, and also changes higher up in the atmosphere, in the stratosphere, as well as changes in factors beyond, such as changes in variation of the power from the sun that can interact with the upper atmosphere of the Earth, and even volcanic eruptions that can affect things like aerosol heating and cooling in different, and chemical reactions in different parts of the higher up in the Earth's atmosphere. So there's actually many factors that can cause the jet stream in the mid-latitudes, and therefore these extreme weather events such as the cold spells to vary. But the Arctic sea ice changes, and we've seen a massive reduction in Arctic sea ice in the last few decades, since about 1980 or so, are certainly one possible cause amongst probably a dozen or more different drivers. The difficulty is that the period of really strong Arctic warming, when the sea ice has been reducing very dramatically, particularly since the 1990s or the early 2000s, is a very short time period in terms of being able to say whether changes in the data are significant or not from a mathematical point of view, given all the variability in the data. So that's why there is a very strong debate in the current literature between different groups of scientists over whether or not there is a direct cause and effect between the very strong Arctic sea ice reduction and the winter cold spells in mid-latitudes. So the jury's still out on that one. We don't really have enough data. And of course, climate models are also used to try to assess this, but the models themselves are not perfect tools. So they're very useful to supplement the data, but the models themselves have their own challenges in using them to decipher the results from them. And so it's really a very active area of research.
Please explain, what is Arctic amplification, the mechanics at play when very cold air can escape the Arctic and move further south?
So Arctic amplification is essentially it's near surface or surface atmospheric warming of the high latitudes. It occurs actually in both hemispheres, so in the southern hemisphere as well, but it's particularly pronounced in the Arctic. And it's where the Arctic near surface or surface air has warmed four times as strongly as the global average warming in the last four decades, so since about 1980s or so. And so this is the most, on average, the most rapidly warming region of the planet is the Arctic. And there's a number of different reasons for this. The main one that has been given, although it's not necessarily the main one that operates in practice, is something called the ice albedo feedback, albedo being reflectivity of the Earth's surface, which dramatically reduces if you're removing ice and snow cover from large parts of the Arctic. That darkens the surface. You absorb extra radiation from the sun. That's when there is the sun. Obviously, during the polar winter, there's not much sun. And so there's actually other feedbacks that are equally, if not more, even more important, such as what we call the ice ocean heat flux feedback. So when you're removing sea ice cover through some initial warming, then you're effectively removing a lid from the ocean, where the ocean is able to radiate a lot more heat compared with before into the lower atmosphere, particularly in the autumn and the early winter. And remember here that when we're talking about cold spells, the winter season is of greatest interest. So this idea about radiating more heat from the sea to the air, I think is a tremendously important mechanism for amplifying the global warming in the Arctic region. And there's other feedbacks as well, and they're acting in tandem to cause this very pronounced warming of the Arctic, as I said, about four times greater than the global warming average.
And your paper's about fast-moving air currents in the stratosphere, about 6 miles or 10 kilometers above the surface. How can changes in the stratosphere rearrange our weather lower down in the troposphere where we live?
That's a really good question. The stratosphere, which is this layer of the atmosphere about 10 or 15 kilometers up to about 50 or more kilometers above the Earth's surface, is not always connected with the lower down part of the atmosphere called the troposphere. But nevertheless, there can be transfer of energy and waves between the two layers of the atmosphere that can influence the conditions in the other layer of the atmosphere where the waves come from. So the waves can propagate either upwards from the troposphere into the stratosphere, or downwards from the stratosphere into the troposphere. And so what we find is that if you have some trigger change in either the jet stream in the troposphere, that this can cause atmospheric blocking. So where you get regions of more stable air masses and high air pressure near the Earth's surface, this can be linked with movement of waves in the air up into the stratosphere, which can in turn influence the what we call the polar vortex, which is a mass of cold air that forms each season in the stratosphere. This can be influenced by conditions in the troposphere, and vice versa. If you have some changing conditions with the polar vortex, which is a mass of cold rotating cold air in the stratosphere, this in turn can propagate down to the troposphere and influence the jet stream there. And this sort of coupling between these two layers of the atmosphere is not entirely well understood, but it can have profound implications or impacts on weather conditions near the Earth's surface. For example, if there's some warming of the stratosphere that can then propagate through this wave action down to the lower part of the atmosphere, the troposphere, and weaken the jet stream in the troposphere, that can then lead to colder air outbreaks forming nearer the Earth's surface in the mid-latitude regions.
A majority of papers examining severe cold air outbreaks are about the United States. I find less about observations in Northern Europe and even less for Russia and China. Are we talking about a global phenomenon, and are there examples in Europe or Russia?
You're right. A lot of the research has been concerned with the impacts of the Eastern and Central North American cold spells in recent years. But we have also had a number of these cold spells in Eurasia and Northern Europe and going as far east as China, Korea and Japan as well. Very notable cold spells, actually. And there have been actually quite a large number of papers on these. There's a very famous example called the Beast from the East that affected Northwest Europe and the UK, for example, in February, March 2018. And actually just last winter, on both sides of the Atlantic, you had a very record cold spell, which propagated unusually far south in the US to affect the Gulf Coast. And in fact, some of the deepest snow on records, or at least back into the late 19th century, and very low temperatures as well over the course of a week or two in January 2025. And also last winter, there were a couple of notable cold air outbreaks coming from the Arctic to affect weather conditions in the UK as well. And so it's argued that these were linked to changes, at least in part to changes in the stratosphere where the polar vortex conditions may have influenced or been linked to jet stream changes lower down in the atmosphere. If you look quite closely at the, there's a huge body of papers being produced. You can find good examples also of cold air outbreaks over Eastern Asia, so particularly Korea and Japan, which are influenced by changes in the near surface, what we call a high pressure that forms over Siberia in many winters due to the very cold continental conditions that form seasonally over Siberia. And that high pressure can be influenced by conditions upstream, so going further northwest with reduced Arctic sea ice that we discussed a bit earlier in this interview about the recent reductions in Arctic sea ice. So, for example, over the Barents Kara Seas, north of Russia, that particular part of the Arctic Ocean has warmed very rapidly in the last two decades or so. And that's influenced some of the conditions in the lower atmosphere above that region, which in turn has had impacts downstream in the atmosphere, which in atmospheric terms means going further east over the Ural region and further east over Siberia, which in turn has caused propagation of cold northerly winds down over that eastern part of Asia. So there's actually quite a body of work that's reported on some of those results. So it is actually pretty much all round the mid-latitude belt, but focused over those particular continental regions where you have certain weather systems preferentially forming because of things like the differences in heating and cooling between the land and the sea. The land tends to cool down the big continents more in the winter than the surrounding oceans, for example, and also connected with the things like Rocky Mountain ranges and the Ural Mountains, which are oriented more or less north-south and influence where some of these weather systems preferentially form.
Well, I know from October 2023 to January 2024, a nasty cold wave settled over Scandinavia and parts of Russia. And while the rest of the world was record warm, this so-called cold blob made a half dozen countries colder than normal for months. And one of the best season forecasters, Copernicus Climate Change Service, did not predict this cold blob, even when their model was started in October 2023, when the cold air had already arrived. What is the problem with predicting these sudden cold air outbreaks, and can we do better?
You see, the thing is, I think all of these climate models are in a continuous cycle of improvement, and we learn from recent events trying to improve the representation of conditions in the real atmosphere. So I think the climate models as a whole tend to struggle with capturing some of the real changes in the atmosphere or the variations of changes in jet streams and so on. They tend to underestimate the strength of these changes, but also some of the climate models still don't have a very good representation of how the stratosphere and the troposphere, so these two vertical layers of the atmosphere that we've spoken about before, how they are coupled and how you can get energy and kind of transfer of information between these two layers of the atmosphere. And also we think that with the atmosphere, you can have nonlinear effects where quite small triggers can result in large changes in different parts of the atmosphere later. So some quite subtle initial signals. It's quite hard to fully represent all these cause and effects in the climate models. So I think there is some skill in climate models at predicting certain types of changes in with the polar vortex in the stratosphere. But as a whole, the models can still be improved.
In your section on stretching of the stratospheric polar vortex, it sounds like there's more energy exchange between the two layers of the atmosphere over the North Pacific and Alaska than, say, over Greenland. Are you saying interaction between the troposphere and the stratosphere is not even or the same all around the pole?
These kind of interactions that you mentioned can be regionally focused because although if you have a weakening of the polar vortex, this massive cold air spinning around the pole in the stratosphere, the way that connects with the troposphere will also be influenced by air pressure systems in the troposphere and the direction of winds regionally in the troposphere. And so those, as I mentioned, are connected quite often with geographic features or mountain ranges or differences in heating and cooling lower down in the atmosphere. So the impacts of having a change in the polar vortex can be regionally focused. And we know that, for example, with regions of blocking or high pressure, which is blocking is in an area of persistent high pressure and still winds lower down in the atmosphere, there's preferential regions where they tend to form, such as Greenland, Alaska, and North Pacific, so regions such as you mentioned. So it's a bit like having giant boulders in a river that can affect the flow of the air in the atmosphere, to give a very simple analogy. Certainly, we do see regionality of that connection between those two atmospheric layers. Again, it's not perfectly understood.
And further complicating stratospheric detective work, there is an almost clock-like wind cycle called the quasi-biennial oscillation, QBO. I hadn't heard a lot about it. I had to look it up. What is it, and can it affect severe winter outbreaks in the mid-latitudes?
So the QBO, or quasi-biennial oscillation, is a another jet stream compared with the one that we've discussed so far. This is a jet stream that is higher up in the atmosphere. It's in the stratosphere, but it's also in the lower latitudes, so the equatorial regions of the northern hemisphere. And it's caused by tropical weather systems producing waves in the atmosphere that, a bit like the waves we previously discussed, can rise from the troposphere into the stratosphere. And then these waves subsequently break in the stratosphere because the air there is relatively rarefied compared with lower down in the atmosphere. This then produces a force that causes this jet stream to form called the QBO. It can reverse direction between east and west every 26 or 28 months or so. And it turns out that if you change conditions high up in the stratosphere, like the QBO in the tropical regions, that this can be connected dynamically, so in terms of movements of air masses in the atmosphere, with changes in higher latitudes. So there's a kind of a figure in our paper that describes these connections. But basically, if you reverse phase of the QBO between west and east, if you make it into an easterly phase, then this can increase the probability of a weakening of the polar vortex in higher latitudes of the stratosphere that we discussed, the polar vortex previously.
And then your team of top scientists say it is time for more study of the stratosphere, giving it a room of its own, so to speak. Why?
I think the issue with the stratosphere is it's higher up. There's traditionally been fewer observations than lower down in the atmosphere. It's more challenging to capture in climate models, which don't necessarily have as much detail in the stratosphere, again, because the weather that we normally experience on an everyday basis is lower down in the atmosphere. So it's been a little bit neglected historically compared with research in the troposphere. However, there has been a lot of research in parts of the stratosphere, but it's been selective in relation to the topic we're discussing today. For example, a lot of previous research has been focused around what we call sudden stratospheric warmings, which is when the stratospheric polar vortex can warm quite rapidly over a period of a few days or so. And then that can also weaken the winds in the polar vortex. And then there's a kind of wave propagation from the stratosphere down to the troposphere. And that can cause a weakening of the jet stream lower down in the atmosphere, and in turn cause some of these cold winter spells that we've been discussing. However, from not just our work that we've been reporting, but from a number of papers recently, it turns out that there are different types of changes in the stratosphere that can influence near-surface weather conditions. And we just wanted to really help draw attention to the fact that we think there's actually a wider diversity or variety of stratospheric anomalies or changes in conditions in the stratosphere that can influence extreme weather lower down in the atmosphere compared with what conventionally has been really looked at with most of previous research. So I think that's it's really drawing attention to the fact that we need a more complete understanding of some of these anomalies and extremes with stratospheric conditions, how they're connected with lower down in the atmosphere and in terms of extreme weather events.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Dr. Edward Hanna is on the line. We are talking severe winter weather and the stratosphere.
In the Severe Weather Europe blog, André Vlies finds three key factors are lined up to predict a serious cold air outbreak next winter. And everybody from city managers to social agencies would like a prediction. Is it too soon? And if so, how far in advance can we know severe cold is on the way?
So that's a really interesting point, and they're really looking at several key factors, including the QBO that we've already discussed, but also conditions, sea ice conditions in the Arctic and how that might be influenced with changes high up in the atmosphere above the Arctic. And then they're also looking at, ENSO, I think, in the Pacific, so El Nino, Southern Oscillation. So what they're trying to do is to predict changes in these three conditions, or looking at recent changes in these conditions, and see if that can give some clues or insights into the next few months' conditions in the stratosphere with the polar vortex activity. And I think there is something in this kind of approach. You can't get a perfect prediction, of course, from just three factors, but it's certainly part of the physical connectivity or potential connectivity of what's happening and trying to, there are some time lags with some of these, what we call teleconnections or remote links between different parts of the atmosphere or different parts of the Earth system. And so that's the basis also of some of the, for example, machine learning prediction models that try to do seasonal weather forecasting that have recently been developed.
Well, we're running out of time, but can you briefly tell us, what are you working on next?
So we're basically trying to follow up on some of the ideas from the big review synthesis paper that motivated this interview. So I think a number of us are working on different parts of what's a very big research area. So some of us looking at changes in high latitude, blocking the causes and impacts of that. Others are looking at new ways of defining variations and extreme events in the stratosphere and trying to understand how this might be linked with conditions further down with some of the extreme cold air outbreaks. But also we're trying to motivate the research from an end user or stakeholder perspective. So for example, with energy users, which is a big topic in the winter with the price of energy now in many parts of the world. For example, I've got a proposal to work with a national energy system operator here, for example, to try to better understand the societal and economic impacts of cold air outbreaks. And I guess if we could improve the weather forecast models and the global climate models to be able to predict these events and understand them, then the energy companies and other interested parties have a longer lead-in time and can make better preparations. So that's one of the ideas. But I think there is a lot more work still to do to improve the climate models. So better predictability is the key, I think, of so that we can better prepare for these events, as well as just understanding them from a scientific perspective.
From the University of Lincoln, we've been speaking with Edward Hanna. He is professor of climate science and meteorology and lead author in a new study about cold air outbreaks. You can find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Edward, thank you for coming back and sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Climate models warn a much hotter world is coming within a single lifetime. This calls for drastic changes to our fossil-fueled civilization. But are those predictions solid? How does a global mean average actually show up in your country? International scientists have been working to cross-check the future against times of past warming. Our guest, Dr. Georgia Grant, helped develop a new tool using carefully analyzed sediments. She is a senior sedimentologist for GNS Science, which is now the new public research organization, Earth Sciences New Zealand. Georgia is a deep past explorer looking for echoes of the future. From Lower Hutt, New Zealand, Georgia Grant, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
In 2019, you investigated sea level rise during the Pliocene epoch with a focus on a short period of about 300,000 years, but it was about 3 million years ago. Why are scientists so interested in that mid-Pliocene warm period?
So this is the kind of touted as the last time Earth had carbon dioxide levels at 400 parts per million, like today. And at that time, the world was about 2 to 3 degrees warmer than present. And I might refer to the term an equilibrium, and so that's what we call when you look at the climate system over a long period, we can see that the temperature warmed to increase CO2.
Well, how could we possibly know the composition of the atmosphere millions of years ago?
Well, there's a couple of ways that we measure that by. The way that we directly measure carbon dioxide is in ice cores, where air bubbles have been trapped within the ice. But prior to ice cores, in the time that we don't have ice to measure from, we use proxies, what we call proxy records. So there can be different elements that respond in a certain way, the ratio of those elements, and we can measure that today. And so we know that when we see those elements rise and fall, it's due to changing carbon dioxide levels.
This ancient warming period with CO2 levels that might have been similar to today, how long did it last and what preceded and followed that warming?
So for the last 50 million years or so, carbon dioxide levels have been dropping. Within that time period, there has been periods of it being slightly warmer and slightly cooler, but that long-term trend has been a response of the ocean predominantly taking up a lot of that carbon dioxide and storing it in sediments and taking it out of the system. That is the cycle that we have perturbed with the burning of fossil fuels and putting back in that carbon dioxide. But for this time period, it is very much within line of as that decrease happened. So it's just the last time that we had 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere.
And after years of collecting clues, how do you picture this previous warm period? I read that Florida was underwater, but did all the ice at the poles melt away?
So the sea level record that we built from sediments in New Zealand show on average that sea level was changing by about 20 metres over a glacial cycle. So it's quite a long time. It occurred over about 20,000 years. For reference, the last glacial maximum, the Ice Age, 20,000 years ago, sea level was 120 metres lower than today. But this was a warmer time period, so it was sea level that had risen above present. So the ice sheets at the moment can contribute 65 metres of sea level if they completely melted. What we saw were changes of about 20 metres, and so that meant a significant loss of the Greenland ice sheet, which holds currently about 7 metres of sea level, and an additional kind of 15 metres from Antarctica, which suggested that we lost a lot of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is mostly a marine-based ice sheet sitting amongst an archipelago, as well as some of the terrestrial ice sheet from East Antarctica.
And at this time, the continents were in about the same position as they are now. And in that previous warming period, around 3 million years ago, what did sea level change mean for New Zealand?
In the scheme of things, well, in my geological brain, 20 metres doesn't change a lot for New Zealand in those past conditions. Today, 20 metres would mean a huge difference for a lot of our ports, and that's, you know, equally across the world. Certainly around the equator and the Pacific Islands and low-lying areas, as you say, like Florida, Bangladesh, those are the locations where just a little bit of sea level change means a huge amount. So I think in the context of today, it has a significant impact.
Yes, just for our American listeners, we're talking about over 75 feet of sea level change. You can imagine what that would mean. Now, Georgia Grant, you found the big climate models could not accurately recreate this ancient warm period. Is that right?
So climate models, the climate system is incredibly complex. And the computer models that various people across the globe have come together to create tend to do one or two parts of those system really well. So they might do the ocean and atmosphere interactions really well, or the ice sheet and ocean interaction really well. To do the whole global system is currently beyond our computer capacity. And so what we tend to do is look at the results of the different climate models and piece them together to understand what that whole system kind of might look like. But as I say, at the moment we don't have a global climate model that can do every single region at a resolution that demonstrates the expression of change that's important for people in those different places.
Well, right. That is another focus in your 2023 paper published by the EGU. Global warming is not going to affect the whole planet equally. It does vary a lot between regions. I've seen a map of heat distribution during the mid-Pliocene, and the biggest heat changes circle and move towards the poles, while the tropics didn't change a lot. Now, that's bad news for my country of Canada, and I guess for New Zealand, too.
Yeah, that's a feature we call polar amplification, and it's the fact that any change in kind of temperature is really felt at the poles, and that's because they have so many aspects that are sensitive to the climate system, and when they change, they act as feedbacks. So they start to play into exacerbating that change. One of the key kind of expressions of that is the ice albedo effect. So white ice, that huge expanse of it, including sea ice seasonally, reflects a lot of heat back into the atmosphere. And when you start to warm the oceans and get rid of the sea ice, and like we've seen recently that the Arctic sea ice field is getting smaller and smaller, that means that more heat is entering the ocean, and that feeds back into the system and makes it harder for the sea ice to grow the next season. But I guess the simple way that I think about that regional expression of warming is that our global average temperature is currently 15 degrees. That's 1.1 degrees above the average of the last 2,000 years. So we've already warmed the globe by 1.1 degrees. But that global average temperature of 15 degrees includes a plus 57 degrees Celsius, you know, recorded in the US, and a minus 90 degrees Celsius recorded in Antarctica. There's a huge difference seasonally and across the globe in how that average temperature expresses itself. So I think it's important when we think about plus 2 degrees, which is the Paris target, that we reduce warming to 2 degrees. That 2 degrees might mean 6 degrees in one place and 1 degree in another place. And those differences have huge impacts on different countries, particularly like New Zealand with the maritime weather, and places like Florida, as you say, because of the increasing extreme weather events that we see.
In a 2008 synthesis of science about this previous warming, the authors concluded the cause of the mid-Pliocene warmth remains unclear. Georgia, do we have a better idea now about what caused that previous warming?
I think the carbon dioxide levels, as I said, during the mid-Pliocene were on a long-term trend of decreasing carbon dioxide. At that time, it might have been slightly elevated from previous periods due to volcanic activity or dissolved carbon in warmer oceans, but it's certainly not considered a spike in CO2. It's just the last time that we had kind of regular interglacial periods where carbon dioxide was above 400 parts per million. So I think my key takeaway is always that it took 3 million years for the Earth to decrease CO2 from that 400 parts per million mark down to our pre-industrial 280 parts per million, and we've undone that in about 200 years.
Wow. I mean, that carbon cycle is slow if left to itself, but we've sped it right up. So your specialty is sediments, including their transport by waves and how that influences data drawn from those sediments, if I understood this correctly. How were the samples collected? How were they protected? And, for example, in your site in New Zealand?
We have a particular sequence of sediments that have been, and by sediments I mean mud and sand, that are deposited kind of near to the coastline and just in that out to 100 metres water depth. So, you know, as you go from the coast, from the beach, you have sandier sediments, and as you walk out, even within that short kind of period, you can feel that sediment getting finer underneath your feet, and eventually it kind of gets just to mud. That sequence was deposited over about 5 million years and then subsequently uplifted, and we now have that record on land. And the way that we access it best is by coring those sediments, and we do that so that we can get a continuous record. It's really important that we know the relative position of those sediments through time. Similar records that are drilled overseas would be kept refrigerated and are kept refrigerated, but we don't really have that infrastructure in New Zealand for this amount of sediment core. And indeed, the resources to keep cores like these, records of Earth history, are under increasing pressure. And we've just seen the disestablishment of the International Ocean Drilling Program from the US that has supported vast amounts of knowledge through ocean drilling, and we have thousands of kilometres of sediment cores that are kept over the world, and it's a huge cost to keep that refrigerated.
Are you basing estimates of climate and ocean conditions a few million years ago directly on microfossils or on chemicals that living things leave behind?
We do both. So some of the temperature, again, proxy records, so it's a proxy of temperature. We're not directly measuring temperature. We can see what kind of species lived, and the ratio of those species tell us what their preferred environment is. We can also measure the chemical traces that they leave behind, like the carbon chain lengths of the carbon molecule from specific marine algae can tell us how much kind of energy was in the system, how hot the temperature was.
Well, this gets a bit technical, but it is another amazing fact of nature. About a million years ago, the timing of glaciers expanding and contracting, so the ice ages, was coincident with 41,000-year cycles of the tilt of the Earth. Then for the last million years, the classic ages that we know, the time shifted to a 100,000-year pattern of the Earth's orbit. Do we know or do we have informed guesses why this great ice clock and climate clock changed?
Yeah, so if you'll let me, I can go into a bit more detail on those cycles, because that was one of the main reasons I got into geology. These are termed Milankovitch cycles. They're the path that Earth's orbit takes about the sun, and that changes how much incoming solar radiation, how much radiation and heat is coming into Earth's system. And there are three main cycles. The 100,000-year cycle is how spherical Earth's orbit is. And that 41,000-year cycle you mentioned is the tilt of Earth's axes. And so that changes how much the poles receive, of how much temperature the poles receive. And then there's a third cycle, the 20,000-year cycle, which changes how our seasons are expressed. And there's a lot of interplay between these cycles. They certainly don't act in isolation. And I think that's the big thing that we're starting to see now, as we are able to recover new sediment records from across the globe, from Antarctica, from Greenland, from the equator. We can see that those cycles are dominant in different places, and that's because there's different parts of the climate system that respond to them. So one of the key things we've seen, learnt recently, is that the different parts of the Antarctic ice sheet, one of them responds better to kind of what we call top-down melting. So that's, you know, how warm it gets in summer determines how much melt there is, whereas other parts of the Antarctic ice sheet, the marine-based, responds more to the 40,000-year or the bottom-up warming, and that's through the ocean system. So that shift from the 41,000-year world to the 100,000-year world has happened because the ice sheets have changed, and as they change in their size and in their location, as we had ice sheets that started to come down from the Arctic across the Northern Hemisphere continents, they started to respond to different thresholds in the system.
In your 2025 paper, you find sea level rise may have been somewhat overestimated, while still shockingly different from today, as much as 45 meters or 150 feet from the lows to the highs. Sea level rise might have been less extreme than some science suggested. You say this means lower ice sheet sensitivity. Now, if this is true, what does that mean for the future, for both sea level rise and how much polar glaciers will retreat?
Well, I think one of the important things to note is, and something that I should have mentioned more frequently in my answers, is that the time frames that I've been talking about are thousands of years. You know, these changes and these responses that I have generally looked at are quite hard to compare to modern change. Part of that is because, you know, as we discussed, the current change is happening a lot faster than the natural system. So there's a huge element to our current global warming that is completely incomparable to any other time in the past, because it's happening so quickly. But as well, these changes are that overall system that's happening, you know, as I said, in equilibrium. So we're not seeing how quickly we're not able to resolve how quickly that change is happening, just what the overall response would be if you change temperature by 2 to 3 degrees. It is also hinting at the fact that background climate states have a huge impact on the ability of the climate system as a whole to respond. So as we start to cross certain thresholds, like the 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide, and head towards 2 degrees warming, we can see features in the climate system like marine-based ice sheets in West Antarctica that can experience runaway melt. So that could happen, that's something that could happen very quickly.
When the funding for the Deep South Challenge was cut by the government in 2024, where does that leave the New Zealand Earth System model?
Yeah, look, that's a really important question, and thank you for asking that. There's certainly been quite a significant amount of defunding of science in New Zealand over the last 3 years, the loss of those long-term programs, and indeed in a number of our different funding grants have been massively reduced. That in some way contributed to the loss of some key staff that worked on the New Zealand Earth System model. And it does somewhat leave, you know, quite a high level of investment that was about 7 years in the making to create this model without much of a future, really. So we're still really waiting to see, I guess, if we can source some further funding to ensure that that model gets continued to develop and used, because it is able to demonstrate and resolve changes across the Southwest Pacific in a way that no other climate model can for New Zealand.
Well, given what we know about this past state of warming and our current failure to control greenhouse gases, Georgia, would you like to personally take a guess of what you think might happen by 2090 or 2100?
I mean, it's not looking great, Alex. As I said, you know, there are certain elements in the system that have very clear capacity to respond in a non-linear way, in a way where we see runaway change. Part of that is the West Antarctic ice sheet. If we start to break up our ice shelves, they act as a buttress to holding back a lot of that ice and also allow the incursion of warmer waters. And when I say warmer waters, I mean it doesn't need to be that warm. 0 degree water is still very warm to ice. You can still quickly melt ice under those conditions. We also have things like the methane cycle. You know, there are our ocean sediments as well as the permafrost that are starting to warm and potentially, you know, release huge amounts of methane, which is a very sensitive greenhouse gas. The important thing in all of this is that we, you know, everything we can do today to reduce our ongoing kind of carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere will make a huge difference in that 80-year time frame.
What are you working on next?
Well, I have recently been to Greenland on one of the International Ocean Drilling Program voyages before they shut down, fortunately. And so I'm really starting to look into the details of the interactions between the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets and what we can learn from that, because as we move forward in the future, I think one of our biggest questions we're facing is which ice sheet is going to respond the quickest and first, and how does that potentially force the other ice sheet to respond. Sea level rise doesn't rise evenly, just like global temperature doesn't rise evenly across the globe. And so it's really important that we know where that ice melt source might come from. That has a huge impact for different parts of the world. So if the Antarctic ice sheet melts, if we get, for example, 1 metre of sea level equivalent from the Antarctic ice sheet, then sea level rises higher than that in the Northern Hemisphere. So it might rise by 1.2 metres around the shores of Canada, sorry to say. And vice versa for New Zealand. If the Greenland ice sheet melts, then we experience higher than average effects of sea level rise. So it's really important that we know which of those ice sheets is more likely to respond and how they interact and impact each other.
We have been speaking with Dr. Georgia Grant. She is senior sedimentologist with the public research organization Earth Sciences of New Zealand. And you can find links to all the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Georgia, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thanks, Alex. It's been a real pleasure.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.